I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. I'm Dr. Howie Jacobson, and this is the Plant Yourself Podcast. Each week, I bring you a conversation with someone who's making a positive difference in the world. And for my day job, I help leaders and their teams master their mindsets so they can achieve great things. To find out more, check out the Mindset Mastery Memo, my Substack newsletter. You can find it at plantyourself.com/memo. And now, today's show. Hey, and welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast. I'm your host, Howard Jacobson. So I'd like to announce very happily that since I've started counting in February, we now have over 20,000 downloads of the Plant Yourself Podcast, which, and I looked this up, is less than a million, but considerably more than zero. So thank you everyone who's downloaded, and especially thanks to those folks who have spread the word, who've posted on Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or LinkedIn or Pinterest or just old-fashioned told your friends and loved ones about it. That's how we grow. Second, I'm starting a show on answering questions. So if you have questions that you'd like me to look at and maybe invite some guests to help answer, go to plantyourself.com/ask. You can either type it in or phone it in. Third, I'd like to let you know that you're not crazy if you think that the sound quality of the podcast has increased greatly over the past several weeks. I took Rich Roll's advice and spent about $500 on great audio equipment or decent audio equipment, which is so much better than what I had. It's kind of like adding a little bit of vegetables to a really bad diet. It doesn't take much to make people notice the difference. So yeah. Finally, today's guests, Anne Kreil Esselstyn and Jane Esselstyn, are two of the cooking powerhouses behind the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease phenomenon, started and led by Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. Husband and father, respectively. So in today's podcast, we talk about the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease cookbook, the recipes in Rip Esselstyn's book, My Beef with Meat, and it is side-splitting. These two ladies are extremely funny, extremely wise, and more than anyone else in the plant-based movement, I think these two understand how to help ordinary people begin to get this kind of food into their lives. Their recipes are really accessible, delicious. They don't require special ingredients. There's almost no tofu in the whole book, which I know is a huge turnoff for people who are prejudiced against tofu. So we talk about lots and lots of really interesting things, and I think you will absolutely fall in love with these two when you meet them. So without further ado, Anne Kreil Esselstyn and Jane Esselstyn, welcome to the Plant Yourself Podcast.
Thank you.
So I've been excited to
talk. Thank you. Sorry, I'm coming in late.
Oh, that's all right. I'm expecting lots of slapstick in this interview from
no worries.
Just from watching you guys, do your food presentations and watching a lot of videos. I'm expecting a lot of I Love Lucy here.
Okay.
So you guys just came out with the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease cookbook, which I have been cooking out of for a while now. And I have to tell you, I love how it tastes, and I really love how accessible and easy it is. Like, I know if I'm there's a lot of cookbooks that I have where if I'm tired or if I haven't just done a shop or if I'm not about to do a shop, I know that there's really nothing in there. But I know that when I open your cookbook, that it's mostly staples, it's stuff I have, and it doesn't really tax me to work on those recipes. So I want to first of all,
that's great.
Thank you. Oh,
shucks. Yeah. So what have you made out of it? What do you like out of it?
Well,
I'm impressed that you cook.
Well, you know, I've got to put my money where my mouth is. So this morning, I tried something new, and I just made it for myself, and I had to, ended up having to make a double batch because everybody else wanted it too. It was the...
Don't tell me it's my mom's oats, my mom's dry oats.
No, no. It was...
I'm just kidding. I don't...
it was the chickpea omelets.
Oh, isn't that amazing? I think that is fabulous.
It's a great recipe. People are.
It is so good. That's Jane absolutely stunned me with that because of the whole idea of omelet is not appealing to me. Anything omelet is egg.
Right. But so. This, and you know, chickpea flour when it's uncooked, I was kind of like doubting myself halfway through. Like, no one's going to want this. This is going to end up in the compost. And yet, once it was cooked through, I could not beat my children away from it. You know, we put on the salsa, and it was so good and so easy that, well, when it was all gone and I hadn't really tasted it yet, I just whipped up another batch. And so my question is that kind of what you were trying to do in this cookbook, make something that really lowered the bar for how much effort and thought and preparation it would take to cook plant strong or plant perfect?
Well, you know, we're not trained chefs or anything. We just cook from experience. And as you just said, the best experience is when you make something that people clamor around and want to eat. And I just knew that, you know, if it's simple to make, it's probably not complicated to eat. I mean, there was no true intention behind it. I knew I wanted to make something that was looked kind of omelet-y. And people have used tofu in the past, and I feel like tofu just automatically complicates the equation because there's bazillion different types of tofu, different textures, different sort of, you know, you can get liquidy ones, silken ones, you know, regular tofu, you know, firm, not firm, smooth. So anyway, no tofu, how can we make it? And that's, I'm so glad you made it this morning and your kids liked it. That's awesome.
Well, you know, I think it's absolutely amazingly delicious, but I'm going to tell you my philosophy on breakfast, and that is that I
Since
feel,
you asked.
Yeah,
which
you,
I did.
Didn't you? You did.
Since you want to know.
I mean, I really feel that breakfast has to be utterly simple, and I think the more you can eat the same thing every day, that's the best. And I mean, for instance, my husband will only eat his oats, only eat. I mean, if I make something else or if somebody else does, he eats his oats and he might have one bite of a pancake or something. But because, you know, then you fall into maybe having to have maple syrup on whatever. So I really do feel like, and the only time you're going to get oats probably because they do have the wonderful properties of lowering cholesterol and lessening inflammation and being dose responsive. So that I like to try and get oats every day and especially into the heart disease patients. So that's why we have so many oat recipes, but Jane just blew the lid off it all. I thought with that one great chickpea.
Well, you know what helps much is the photographer nailed a great picture on that one. Don't you think it's a good picture?
Yeah, I wouldn't have made it if it wasn't for the picture.
There you go.
You know,
I swear.
The ingredients didn't honestly, when I just looked at the recipe, I wasn't excited. The picture, you know, was enough of a bikini shot to get me to try it.
Oh,
and then it was just delicious.
Yeah. So, that's funny.
So yeah, I mean, so
you see, I have my breakfast in there that I sometimes have, not all the time.
Will you please flip to the page of her breakfast? It's just horrible. They wouldn't let me write what I wanted to write. I wanted to say, this is horrifyingly dry.
Well, you know what?
Frighteningly dry.
You said it in there. Anne's oats with grapes.
Yes.
Okay,
so that's
so
the complicated. That is the complicated recipe. Oats and grapes. That's all.
She doesn't have any liquid. She eats it dry.
But if each bite has a wet grape, it is surprisingly good. You have to have enough grapes, red
uh-huh.
grapes,
and you have to have
anyway.
Some DNA that came from a horse in your body somewhere. Just, anyway.
So we're.
Right.
So breakfast is basically easy.
Right. Or make it easy for yourself so you eat it every morning. Otherwise, you're going to
stop somewhere and get a breakfast, Luna Bar or whatever.
Right. Well, I think it seems like that's your philosophy, is just make it as easy as you possibly can. When I think about how I used to eat breakfast when I was eating crap, I didn't wake up every morning and look for new recipes. I would have the same cereal with the same milk, the same toast. If I was having a sausage, I would just have a frozen pack of sausages. I would just have the same, I did not want variety in the morning. My brain wasn't awake enough to process, anything new. So we're keeping the same principle of least effort and just applying it to healthy choices.
Totally. Totally agree. And I think, you can have a hot oatmeal, not cooked oatmeal. Anyway, go for some oatmeal, oats of some kind.
Steel cut, anything, yeah.
Right. So the other recipe that we make all the time is from the My Beef with Meat, which, Jane, you included the recipes
That's
for that
Jane.
One. This was the cheesy shiitake steel cut oats.
Isn't that a great savory oats?
That is amazing.
That.
We have that in our book also. And there's a picture too. And
not as much a bikini shot as the chickpea omelet, apparently.
Yeah.
But
we have a version, and I have a new version that I'm eating every day now. And I just have the idea of the oats and shiitake, and I'm now putting kale in it.
Mm.
And I mean, you get it all in one bundle. So in the one in our book, we have greens in there too.
Nice.
So it's
what I did with that, we made it four times in a row after we came back from Plant Stock 2013 with the cookbook. And then I'm like, this is getting to be a bit of a pain because I'm making it every day. So what I just did is I made a huge hunk of the dry stuff and then just put it into ball jars. Just screw the lid on. And so now I just take whatever it is, like a 3 tablespoons of that in the liquid with the oats and put it in the pressure cooker for 3 minutes. And I don't even have to think anymore. I don't have to measure, turmeric and
how funny.
Well, perfect. Yeah. But the other thing to do with that is to make a double recipe and then just have it in little jars, put it in your sizes, and then all you do is take it out, put it in the microwave.
Once it's made, I would eat it all.
No, you don't. You decide you're going to...
Oh, don't you doubt to me about willpower. My mom could eat the house. She eats more than anyone I know.
I know that feeling of making the double batch, and then the kids are out the door before they've had as much as I thought they were going to have, and then the thing sits there on the stove all day, like begging me to come lick the wooden spoon.
Yeah. That's right.
So
another thing that is delicious and so surprising is that, I have this thing, this is in me, of wanting to have oats, maybe chia seeds, a banana for breakfast in some way or another, those things. And so one day I put my oats into the waffle iron, and I probably spent about half a year trying to figure out how to make it really work. So I have in this cookbook on page 52 a great picture of my all-oat waffles, which is really pretty simple. It's a banana and oats and water, or you could have dairy milk if you want. Non-dairy milk. Did I say dairy milk?
Yeah.
And flax seeds. And it works. You don't need anything else. And it works into good little waffles.
You do need a non-stick waffle pan.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
But,
that
would be so helpful.
And I tell you, I had so many times when it stuck, but you just take a chopstick and take it off, and you can eat it in little chunks out of
standing
the
right there in front of your waffle pan.
What doesn't taste better when it's shaped like a waffle?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, so our waffle picture is a beautiful picture.
Right, but
and what's awesome on it, and it's good on a lot of other things, is we just took plain old raspberries, frozen raspberries, and blended them up, and then added a tablespoon of raspberry balsamic vinegar, or you don't even need to, and that makes a really wonderful syrup-like.
Mm. All right, tomorrow.
And it's really simple. So, really, you know, really simple.
I love how you're thinking about this, which is, you know, there's a lot of talk in the plant-based movement about how to get people to transition. And it seems like what you guys are doing, and certainly what Rip did with the firefighters, is just look at exactly what they're eating, assume they like it, and just keep giving them the same stuff. It looks like what they're used to.
Yeah. They're great. You can have great lasagnas that look just like, you know, or every lasagna, and
cauliflower buffalo wings.
Well, also, but you know, the other thing that on a lasagna, for instance, if you put some nutritional yeast on the top, it looks as if you've got cheese on there, and it's amazing what you can do with, if you want to make things look just like what you used to have. Now, Howard, I hear what you're saying about food, because so much plant-based food or vegan food can just be sort of this grain, those beans, that veggie. It's just these one bowl meals, which we honestly probably, I would say, we live off those. You know, rice and beans, quinoa and curry and, you know, whatever. We have all those one bowl meals, but it's fun to have some meals that are familiar and look enough like what you previously had and taste close enough that you're like, all right, this is awesome. I can go this route.
Right.
Extraordinarily healthier.
Yeah, because there's so many, you know, I have a lot of vegan cookbooks that have just beautiful pictures of food, but it's unfamiliar to people who have been eating a standard American diet. Or there's a lot of vegan food that is just delicious that, you know, looks like the cat vomited it up.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, I think there was a really interesting study a little while ago about giving wine experts white wine, but they had dyed it red, and the wine experts all described the wine as was red wine. So these are experts. And so when you say put some nutritional yeast on top of lasagna and look like cheese, that's enough for people. Our brains will fill in the rest, and we're like, this is a cheesy lasagna. This is great.
And we have an eat loaf, which is on page 184, I think. And it's really great. And it looks, you know, just like the old meatloaf. And in fact, I was stunned. Essie and I were just in California talking. And they just chose recipes out of this Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease cookbook.
It was a hospital they were
speaking of. Hospital did this. And they chose, one of the things was the eat loaf. And it was amazing. I mean, people loved it. It was so fun.
Hmm. Well, eat loaf looks like one of those things that would be really easy for big food service to get behind.
Yeah. Because
there's so many things you try to get, you know, hotels or institutions to cook.
And it doesn't work.
It breaks their system. But this is like, you know, they'd be making the same sort of thing anyway, just with breadcrumbs and eggs and
MSG. And meat, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, another thing that looks familiar is our kale stuffed tugboats. They're just potatoes restuffed.
Oh.
And the different thing to bake the potatoes, and then along with baking the potatoes, I baked an onion and garlic in aluminum foil or whatever. You can line it with parchment paper, and so that you use the onion as part of your liquid in the potato and mashing the potato up to restuff, and stick other things in. You can put whatever you want.
Yeah, but that corn and kale,
that's kind of a different little twist.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, nutritional yeast is the key thing in making great mashed potatoes. It is just amazing how it makes them so rich and delicious.
Yep. I discovered the limitations of nutritional yeast last week. I was making a polenta, and I was going to put in like a 3 or 4 tablespoons as I was cooking it, and I forgot that I didn't have the shaker top on, and I put in probably more nutritional yeast than polenta.
Oh, God.
And that was the first time ever it didn't improve a dish.
Oh, my God. That's hilarious. You should have just added more water and more polenta.
or more cornmeal.
Yeah, at that point, I just went to the, you know, to the Hall of Shame and
dump.
So I was just looking for the tugboats in the cookbook, and I accidentally thumbed to the back, and I saw in the dessert section you have a kale cake.
Oh,
seriously?
Isn't she the best?
Seriously?
Isn't she the best? That was Jane's.
You know, you've seen that already. That kale cake is the best.
I love someone from Amazon, someone on their Amazon reviews wrote, "This cake looks like it came fell off of Venus, but it tastes out of this world." So I love that review because it was so fun to make it. It was awesome.
Yeah, I mean,
blue blueberry frosting.
It's the very sort of bright purple blue frosting with a green. It definitely looks like this didn't have to be photoshopped.
No, it didn't. And my I have to say that my inspiration came from Dr. Esselstyn and Dr. Seuss. Yeah. Hey, the tugboats are on page 192.
192.
Yeah.
Cool.
A picture of them. But that kale cake is just stunningly delicious. And you know, the other thing, speaking of raspberry sauce, which of course we were talking about, it is amazing to take just ripe mangoes, and this is on page 250, the Mango Magic with Raspberry Sauce, and you just take mangoes and blend them, maybe with a little oat milk, and then put on a little of that raspberry sauce on the top, and it's just so easy and so good.
Mm. Cool. So I want to come back to recipes, but I want to sort of, you know, go back in time a little bit. And I'm really curious about how people come to this way of eating. And I was just talking to Karen and Colin Campbell's youngest son, Tom, asking him about, you know, what was it like when your family transitioned? Because he was sort of a kid at the time. You know, was it hard? And he's like, you know what? I didn't even notice. The evidence was accruing so gradually over so many years that it just became the way we did things, and there was never a moment where anything looked like it was happening. So I'm wondering, for your family, you had the beginning of the study in 85. So when did you start the research, moving into household?
Yeah, it would be different from my answer and Jane. So I'll answer first, Anne.
Okay.
And that is that my husband decided we're going to do this, so we did it. Now, when we first started way back, we did not eliminate in the very beginning, because we just didn't know, every bit of, I mean, we have all cheese, you know, but we had some, like, no-fat yogurt, and I think maybe that we had egg whites for a while. But otherwise, we just did it. I mean, and I think if you have an issue, if you have heart disease, I think it's ridiculous to go in gently. I just think you do it 100% because the results are immediate. I mean, you immediately find those results. And I think if it's a family, Jane, you can speak. Or, I mean, I think our kids, it probably didn't notice exactly.
Oh, no, we totally noticed. we were all in college. And my
not our youngest.
No, three of the four of us were in college, and I remember calling home one day, and my brother Zeb answered the phone, and he's like, "Mommy, Daddy have stopped eating all meat and sugar and salt and fat and oil," and I was like, "Oh, what's going on?" And so basically, my dad had decided that he wanted to be able to eat this way to make sure he could tell his patients to eat this way.
Uh-huh.
And which I love, that sort of Gandhian approach. And so they did so, and thus they educated us as a family. My youngest brother obviously was home for another, I think he had like a year and a half at home still, and then the rest of us were in college, and we would come home for vacations and summertime still. So we got indoctrinated in this way of eating and then took it back to our schools, and some of our friends, you know, would question us or be like, "Okay, I'll eat this way with you for a while, or I'll try." So it was kind of nice that we could come home and get educated, and then we would try it on our own in school. And I remember just sort of living off grape nuts, you know, at the time we were eating like the no-fat yogurt,
and just living off of that for a long time and not really having much choices to that I could make.
Well, way before you guys went off to college, oats were something that everybody was eating. And I know that, that went to college with our kids, and I was always amazed at how it spread through their friends.
Yeah, we always
eating the oats for breakfast. I mean, you know, not cooked, just as a cold cereal.
So,
that was interesting.
So
but I think, but for so many people ask, oh, I've got little children, what shall I do? And I just think you have to just keep at it. Just keep exposing them. Have them try one leaf of the one leaf of the kale or one leaf of a Brussels sprout. And, you know, eventually they're going to come around. You just don't ever give up because you are the role model.
Uh-huh. Well, so Jane, I'm curious from your perspective, what did your folks do right? Because I know, you know, I have a 19-year-old daughter,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, she eats very well, and I've, you know, been able to influence her since, you know, early childhood. But I imagine coming home now and saying, hey, I've discovered this new thing, let's all change, that would pose a lot of challenges. What do you recommend? What do you remember as having been done right that sort of invited you and convinced you as opposed to just making you dig in your heels?
Oh, no. I mean, he was talking about stuff with his patients and their health, and we were athletes. We all swam for our universities at that time, and I think we were just so tuned into anatomy, physiology, our power and strength as athletes, and our health, and it just all kind of clicked, and we didn't really. We knew our parents weren't crazy, so we weren't pushing back like, you guys are bizarre. Because honestly, I've tried to think, what in my life could someone present to me in a movie or in a book or just through a conversation? What could they do that would change a huge part of my life? I know, like, nutritionally, I'm pretty much set on eating this way. So I'm thinking, like, the only thing that could change is someone could, change or introduce a religion to me. Or I mean, there's nothing that I feel like I can understand what a big change my parents made for us because it was huge and it now makes sense to us ethically, morally, spiritually, environmentally, economically. It just makes so much sense. But I don't know what to compare it to, but I know it was really big. So asking people to change their way of eating is a big deal. I think we were all young enough but old enough to understand it in order to internalize it and embrace it. I know my kids, you know, they, at home, it's like we're kosher at home, we eat this way, but they off to school, they don't eat meat, they don't drink milk, but they'll get carried away in some big birthday party, and they'll have, you know, who knows what kind of cake and ice cream or cheese pizza at a party that wouldn't have pepperoni or anything, but, you know, they are making their way the way that we have to make our way. So there's no part of me that feels the need to make my kids be 100% eating the way we do when they're out and around. I mean, at home, they're going to get whole grain, this and that. Last night, we had a potato bar. So just
yeah, and we have, Ashley and I have 4 children and 10 grandchildren, and everybody is plant-based. And it's just evolved to be that. It's wonderful.
So
it is a great gift.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's the biggest gift you can give your children is to expose
the knowledge
them to
of it, yeah.
And even if they don't do it 100%, even if they don't do it 100%,
they have the knowledge of it. Is what I agree. And then they can always return to it or come back to it, or that's where they, I think it's so. Well, Howard, you probably feel the same way. It's such a nice thing for your kids to know about.
Yeah, and you know, even when they're not, you know, 100%.
Yeah, at Halloween, my kids take a deep dive into the candy bag, and then they just surface about a week later, like, ugh.
Right, but you know, I mean, I still just compare it to like the, you know, I heard a talk by Janice Stanger this past weekend, who was talking about like a pattern value for diet, like from negative 10 to 10. And if you look at foods that harm, like most people are at around negative 8, negative 9. Some people are at negative 10. And I try to be at, you know, plus 9, plus 10. And the truth is that when my kids are eating terribly, they're at plus 7.
Yes.
Like, that's right.
Yeah. It's kind of like a Doug Lau has a similar, like, A, B, C, D. But yeah, sometimes you eat a B minus day. But, you know, you won't find them eating, you know, the F, you know, the meat and the deep fried meat or whatever an F is.
So I'm curious about, when Essie came home and said, all right, I'm convinced this is the way to eat and I need to eat this way because I need to tell my patients to eat this way. What did you, Anne, have to do to learn how to cook this way? What was the first thing you did?
There was absolutely nobody doing it. We just had to do it. I mean, actually, the McDougals were there, but that was the only person out ahead. And the internet wasn't there then, so there was nothing. I mean, but that's the fun, actually. The fun isn't following a recipe to me. The fun is just thinking, oh, you know, I want to try this, but I'm going to leave that out. And that's kind of fun. Sometimes it's good.
Some people don't find that fun. Some people just are daunted by that. But I'm so glad I have my mom's genes, and it is. It's kind of like, all right, forget that. Let's figure it out this way.
So if your dinner had been like, you know, steak with mashed potatoes and green beans from a can, like,
well, you can have mashed potatoes and portobello mushroom as a, you know, that's like a piece of steak. Grilled portobello mushroom, they're great. Or even barbecue. Then you can have the green, barbecue, the bean greens. Yeah.
So it's basically looking at what you're already having and then just figuring out pleasing substitutions?
Yeah. And, you know, and instead of meat, potatoes, rice, sweet potatoes, pasta can be your meat, so to speak. Or just, you know, we have huge salads, just huge. I mean, I tell you, Essie and I split every night this huge salad, and when we go out, he goes to the salad that looks like half of what I make, and he takes this big portion, and I look at him and say, you know, there are 6 more people that have to eat from that. So it's you know, and it's great to start your meal with a huge salad.
So I'm also imagining if you started this sort of in the early 80s, that there were a ton of really good ingredients that are probably staples in your kitchens right now that you had never heard of.
We had never heard of quinoa back then.
Yeah. Can you remember sort of
nutritional yeast we hadn't heard of?
When did you discover nutritional yeast? What was that?
I don't remember.
I heard about it in college, and I worked for Outward Bound, and lots of Outward Bound people are kind of, especially in the 80s, 90s, they were sort of hippie-ish, and everyone had heard of nutritional yeast. And
I tell you what, I hadn't. I grew up using vinegar to make Easter eggs, and I never used it any other place. and now we've discovered some of these infused vinegars.
Oh, my mom is made of vinegar.
And so today I use them often, like if I make a soup and it is bland, I will put some vinegar in it. It makes all the difference. And some of my husband's patients just use some of these great balsamic vinegars as a salad dressing.
Like black walnut or...
No, not black... Yeah, not black walnut.
Yes, it is.
It's not black walnut, Jane.
Oh.
It's
what is it?
Now you've gotten me
I
all,
know.
All,
I think
all,
it is
all
black
concerned. It's black currant.
Black currant.
Okay.
But there's great
favorites.
Flavors, like lemons, great. I had a mango balsamic for a while that I used it like I was my mom, just on everything.
Yeah, and it's you know, most of us are looking for...
Oh, I know. Excuse me. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say hummus is something that we had not eaten really much of. And that has also become a real staple. I mean, it's become our mayonnaise.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not in our life before.
Right.
And we maybe had heard of soy milk and stuff, but we don't use soy milk in anything, ever. We
I have oat milk, OAT, and almond milk. And that's about it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I know my kids love oat milk on cereal sometimes.
I was going to say that, you know, what we want out of our food is flavor, but we don't need 43 different flavors every day. If there's, you know, a balsamic vinegar, an infusion that you like, or nutritional yeast, or we've gone through a phrase where we just put some Dijon mustard in everything.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just a kick that takes it beyond bland. And it really doesn't matter what it is, as long as it goes with the dish.
Yeah. Totally, and the mustards are good. I mean, our favorite, Jane has a fabulous salad dressing, and Essie and I have one we use every night, which is hummus, some kind of a vinegar, balsamic vinegar usually, a mustard, and maybe a half an orange, the little chunks included, or just the juice.
Yeah, and that's his favorite. So, what page is it on, Mommy? Is the book in front of you?
Oh, look, but it's you know, I think finding a good salad dressing is a key thing for people to do.
Yeah, and my favorite one is just 3-2-1, 3 tablespoons balsamic, 2 tablespoons mustard, and then 1 tablespoon maple syrup. Because your tongue is looking for 4 things. Your tongue, as you know, is looking for sweet, salt, acid, and fat. And since you're taking away fat, you're taking away the overwhelming salt flavor in things, you really have to get your tongue excited by acid and spices and distract it. And the Dijon's got a great amount of vinegar in it. So it's just the power of, there's so many other flavors out there besides oil and salt. And it's like the American diet, the American tongue, the American brain is seeking all that, you know, that mouthfeel of oil and salt. And there's just so many other amazing things to behold.
At the opening of our salad, I mean, because we do think finding a salad dressing makes a huge difference. And we have the most wonderful picture of a whole variety of our salad dressing.
What page is that on?
On the opening page of the book, which is about page 166. No, yeah. And it's just... there's just such a variety of things, and it's just, I think salad dressing is such a personal thing. You know, you like what you like. And
I love that, you know, so you've got 9 different jars here of salad dressing. And
I hope we have 9 salad dressings in the book.
None of them is separated. Like, if you know, you'd need like a, you know, someone with a whisk coming in every 2 seconds to take this picture if they were traditional oil-based salad dressings. They're all emulsified. They have no oil.
Yeah. They don't need emulsification. We have 12 salad dressings in the book.
We got a bit of feedback on Amazon from a comment saying that there were too many salad dressings.
Hmm. Yeah.
And people often say they need, you can't win.
Well, you know, when I was eating lots of junk food, I was very happy with the same junk food. Like when I was eating Oreos, you know, I didn't need 12 varieties of Oreos. And now that I'm eating salads, you know, one good salad dressing is really all.
That's all you need. Yeah, totally. And occasionally you can, I mean, you know, we have so many because in some cases we have used something in another dish that kind of makes it a little different. And we put the salad dressing there so people could try it if they wanted. But I do think, I urge people starting this to do, one of the first things to try is to try and figure out a salad dressing you like without oil. It's a huge help.
So let's talk about without oil a little bit more. So I have lots and lots of great cookbooks, and even the really healthy ones, with just a few exceptions, start out with, you know, you chop up all your vegetables and you add 1 to 2 tablespoons of olive oil to your pan.
Yeah, and blah, blah, blah.
And so, you know, I didn't know that there was another way to go. So if how do you teach people, what do you tell people, and what do you do to, you know, cook vegetables, saute, stir fry, braise, anything like that, without that 1 to 2 tablespoons of oil that seems like a prerequisite?
Well, you can't do all the fancy things you just said. You could cook vegetables, and all you need is a pan with a bottom and a source of heat.
Okay.
It did.
So what does that look like? So if I'm not
a pan over the overheat and go.
So I've got my chopped onions. I just throw them in and stir them without
oil. Put them in the pan.
No. Well, no. We have a section about basics, and if you want to sort of use the onions, have them sort of give a nice color to them.
I mean, you can coat them with a little bit of water in the pan, and they get sort of see-through and white. But I like to have my onions have a little bit of color caramelization going. So make the pan hot, 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 so hot that a bead of water pearls around on top. It doesn't just dissolve. It just sort of stays solid as a drop of water.
See page 26.
It has
the caramelized onions and how to cook them.
And it is
amazing. Once you understand how to do this, Jane, keep telling.
You've cooked your onion, but you just stir it over this high heat and slowly start to turn it down, and you can see some stuff sticking to the pan, which is, as you know, it's some of the onion's essence. It's water and it's natural occurring sugar sweetness, and you pour a little water in the pan, and it sticks, or pour some beer in the pan, whatever you're cooking with. Pour some veggie broth in the pan. And it lifts off and it coats on the onion, and put your garlic in, your peppers and your mushrooms, and you just slowly turn the heat down, and you cook everything together, and the moisture comes out, and it looks like cooked vegetables, but they just are not coated in oil.
What I think people don't realize is that onions have got a lot of liquid in them. I mean, they just don't need all that, any oil. They really cook in their own liquid.
And when you eat vegetables without oil, you realize how great they taste and all the texture. And then if you have some veggies with oil, you feel like you've had someone squirt sunscreen in your mouth. It just feels like this big, slippery, melted chapstick. Oh my gosh, what is this? Just viscous, yucky feeling.
That was my experience this morning with those with that omelet, the chickpea omelet, which I put on the caramelized onions and the sautéed mushrooms.
Oh, good.
And I tell you, I ate an awful lot. It was really tasty. There's like, 4 pancakes left on the plate. I had 2 of them. And I could have eaten
all 4.
I was quite full. I was really full, but that fullness did not come with a side of self-loathing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Which I sometimes get when I've eaten something a little bit greasy.
Yeah.
And I just, just want to just...
That's great.
Roll around in like cockroach position until it passed. I just felt full, like I'd eaten enough, but it was all clean.
Yeah, nice. Well done.
Yeah. Well, thanks for the help.
Well, I do think once people get that they can, that all you need, any liquid works too. When you need a liquid, when you're cooking without oil, anything will work instead. That's a big sort of help to know how you can proceed.
Right. Although I will say that when I put in balsamic vinegar now, I stand back from the pot, from the pan a little bit, so it doesn't. So the fumes don't go up my nose.
Nice. That's funny. Oh, how last night my parents were coming home from Italy last night, and they were arriving so late, and I knew they couldn't get. They don't get a lot of food they like on airplanes, obviously. And many times they can, make your own burrito places have things you can dodge your way around. I knew those places would be closed when they came home, so I took over some of the potato bar that we had to their house, and the main thing I made for them was mommy's mushroom gravy. And I caved it on. And it speaks to what you just talked about. I cooked in the pan just onions and garlic, and then to this, onions and garlic mixture, you add mushrooms, and they start to just sort of lose all their fluid, and they, cook, and it smells great. And then you add the broth and the pepper and the little bit of gluten-free flour. I added oat flour. No, barley flour. I added who knows what kind of flour. It doesn't even matter. Just two tablespoons. And then just cooks down into such a gravy, yummy, thick, luscious, like, who wouldn't want to have this all over their potatoes and their rice and their pasta and their... You just put on everything. Put on your partner. Ha! Anyway, it just was so yummy, and it was... It's my mom's recipe, and I was making it, and I was like, God, I'm so psyched that she knew how to make this, because I love making it for potato bar.
Oh, it's wine. I mean, with Thanksgiving coming up, it's the first dish that's empty. We need to make more of it every year. It's on page 115. There's a picture of the gravy on mashed potatoes.
Yeah, why don't we eat gravy every day? It's like everybody's favorite food.
In this one, you should. Go forth and eat gravy. Mommy's Mushroom Gravy 2.0. And we call it 2.0 because in my beef with meat, we have Mommy's Mushroom Gravy, but for the heart disease patients, we had to change the recipe to have, well, we wanted it to have a lot less sodium, and it is, I think I halved everything and added more onion or something. Anyway, we changed it enough that we could call it a new recipe, and it is better than the salty one, I swear. One other thing that we really have tried to do in this book, we use no nuts, almost no salt, and no sugar. We chose maple syrup as the sweetener that we used because it's so expensive and because it has the least amount of fructose of many of the sweeteners. And trace bits of other minerals and things. But what we have worked hard to do is to put some kind of greens in as many places as we possibly could. And so you'll see kale or collards or Swiss chard or something added to most everything where we can logically add it. But my favorite thing and what we're going to have for lunch today is a kale sandwich. And that is amazing. And it's on page, I'm going to tell you if I can, on page 62 in the cookbook. And the key to it is thin slices of lemon. Not just the lemon pulp, but everything. The skin, the pulp, the white. Really thin on top of the hummus. And then you put the kale on top of that. And your tongue hits that acid and it goes, woo! And it's all it needs. It's great.
Wow.
You got to try that one, Howard. You'll love that.
That looks great.
And then, so good.
And is that lemon zest on top? Looks like a little bit of...
Yeah, that's lemon zest.
Parmesan?
No, there is lemon zest on top.
Mrs. Dash.
But also Mrs. Dash...
lemon pepper.
Or Frontier lemon pepper. Love that lemon pepper.
Yeah, this totally... Just the visual is like remembering grated Parmesan cheese. So I'm sure when I taste it... Some part of my brain will fire those sympathetic happy neurons.
Yeah, at least satiated ahead of time, yeah. Perfect.
So, Jane, picking up on your comment about you could put gravy on your partner.
I knew you were going to transition.
That was such a transition.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Ken. So you also work not just as a food and health educator, but as a sex and health educator. Can you talk a little bit about what you do? Yeah.
I'm an RN, I'm a nurse, but I do mostly education, obviously, with our food and cookbooks and our immersions and retreats. But I work as a middle school sex ed teacher, kind of in a variety of different schools. And I love it because middle school sexuality education is really very similar to talking to people about food, because what you're really talking about is, hey, this is preparatory guidance for what's ahead of you. Because in middle school, everyone's, kids are roughly, almost everyone is going through puberty or has gone through puberty or is doomed to go through puberty any minute. So that's the age and stage of life when they become functionally capable of sexual reproduction. So you need to talk about this stuff. Actually, you need to talk about stuff ahead of puberty in some ways. But in schools, they have it in middle school often. And so it's preparatory guidance for what's coming their way, and you want them to make good choices, which is exactly the same thing we're trying to do with food, is we're trying to, hey, preparatory guidance, steer clear of diseases and feeling, low energy and having, medication in your life. Let's stay away from that stuff, and here's how you can make good choices to do that, to have a wake up every morning with energy when a body that is not, burdened by weight and pain, but just feels good and springy and strong.
So what have you learned through your career in teaching middle schoolers about sex, which I'm imagining is not
sexuality without, education. I never use the word sex. Sex means gender.
Sexuality education.
Yep.
Thank you. What have you learned in doing that? I'm imagining that that's not without its challenges in terms of getting people to open their minds, to relax, to be able to discuss things that feel undiscussable. Are there
yeah.
parallels between that work and the work you're doing around nutrition?
Oh, totally. I mean, and you've probably seen it yourself with the work, you know, your books, your work. Is some people they're really, really resistant to the message. Be it around their kids learning about sex ed, or you know, or them changing their ideas about what food is. I mean, some people are like, oh no, my child is so innocent. No. They're just no. Meanwhile, in class, it's their kid asking all these questions because at home they have to pretend to be this innocent little child who's living on the internet or something. But I mean, not always by any means. But some people don't really aren't open to hearing something until they get, you know, hit over the head by it. Hmm. Hopefully it's not your child doing something that they needed to not do, or if it's you needing to get a stent put in because you ate too much grease, meat, and cheese. So it is a lot of parallels. I mean, I think it's so similar, and, you know, you can't come on too strong, you can't come on to this. Some people like the shock value, some people don't like the shock value. Everyone has their stories to tell. Very similar to me.
What I see when I see you work, and I see when I see both of you particularly presenting, is that one of your main tactics is humor.
Yeah, and that's the shortest distance between two thoughts.
Say more about that.
No, I think that if people can hear the humor, and if you can try to deliver humor around something that's kind of intense, around talking to kids about this topic, that people have really built up a charge around it, it helps you then realize, okay, it's okay. The ice isn't that sand. It's okay. I can head out this way. It's not that treacherous. And same with eating this way. You know, look, yay, taste that. Tastes good. You see, it's not as freaky as you thought it was going to be. It's not bark and fuzz. It's food. So I think there's fear and concern and around food and sex. But I do like what I work in, food and sex. What a great thing to have to think about every day.
And it all comes down to gravy.
Yeah, and it all comes down to gravy.
Good gravy.
But yeah, so sexuality education is it.
Gotcha.
But thank you for asking. It is. It's funny how it's similar in my mind. I think in not many people's minds are they the same, but people want to be, tell me what to do. Just tell me what to do. What do I say? What do I eat? What do I tell my kid? What do I do? Just tell me. Like, you can do it. No. What did you say to your kid? What did you say? What did you have for breakfast?
Well, the frightening thing to me is what the internet has done to sex. That anybody who is probably over 18 doesn't realize. I mean, I think all these parents are totally ignorant as to what the shocking things their children are seeing and can see and hear on the internet that they don't even know, you know, and they've never even conceived of anything as sort of ghastly.
Yeah. Well, I remember I was teaching elementary and middle school when the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke.
Yeah.
And I thought this I'm going to have to explain oral sex to kids much younger than I've ever had to before.
That's exactly what happens, and
at least there was it was on the news then. Now it's just on their phone in their room in the dark with no one to explain it.
Yeah.
Except Jane.
No, please, that sounds creepy.
You're so good at it. Yeah, for sure.
Right. Well, but it's, you know, it's, I think they're, it's part of a huge problem or a huge opportunity for us, which is we live in a culture in which almost all of the messages that our kids get and then we get come from interests who don't have our interests at heart, whether it's about food or sex or politics. You know, one of the things we have to teach people is to regain responsibility for themselves, for their kids. And I think it's all part of the same thing. We can't pretend this stuff doesn't exist. So we have to be able to confront it, and we have to have it, you know, maybe more front and center than we'd be comfortable with, so that we can exert our own influence and help our kids see that we're the ones who care about them.
You know, that makes me think of something I meant to say earlier in answer to one of your questions, but it refers to what I think. One of the most powerful things I think that's happened in the eating part of this, not the sex, was the movie Forks Over Knives, and I think it was so powerful because what it did, at least what we have noticed that it did, is so often when a doctor or someone says, you should change how you eat, you know, you immediately bristle and put your hands up. I don't want to be told what to do. But if people see that movie, suddenly it's like it comes from within them. Oh, my goodness, that's something maybe I should be doing. And so that it gives them a whole new different mindset as to how to, you know, what maybe changes they can make to themselves in eating differently. So that, I thought, was a very nice tool in helping people to change. And if someone is bristling about doing it, you know, that might be an interesting movie for a family to watch altogether.
Yeah, I've found the same thing. It's such a great tool to, you know, it has a great storyline.
Yeah.
It has great characters. It's entertaining. It's not that long. And I just tell people, let's save both of our time. Watch this movie, and then if you're still interested, talk to me.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And maybe did you show them Cowspiracy also? Have you seen Cowspiracy?
I just saw it in Austin.
Yeah, wasn't that great?
That's some scary stuff.
I know. It was amazing. Yeah. It was amazing.
So, talking about the movie, so Anne, you're one of the stars of the movie.
Oh, I'm...
And I was thinking specifically, we talked about this before we started recording, one of Essie's patients, Sandera Nation, was, you know, working really hard to incorporate this diet into her lifestyle. And she was saying, you know, the Esselstyns would call me, they would talk to me all the time. They would support me. And one time I was at Walmart and I was really craving something. And then my phone rings and it's Anne. And she's like, don't buy anything at Walmart. Put that crap back on the shelf. And so I'm curious. So I know you were, you know, Essie enlisted you to help, to feed him so that he could tell his patients what to eat in a very Gandhi-esque fashion. But how did you come to become the sort of nutritional and spiritual advisor for so many people?
Oh, she can't help herself. That's why. We have
good.
There are too many people now for us to be on top of everybody, but if anybody calls or emails, I mean, I want to tell you that my husband is on the phone all day long, and he loves it. I mean, he loves it from the airport, in the car going to the airport. He is answering people's emails. And one
today in yoga class, I was bending down downward dog, and the woman next to me goes, I need your dad's number. I have a friend who needs to go see him. She's got heart disease. And I'm like, I have no idea who you are. Like, okay.
So that's just particularly amazing what he does to respond to all the people that write. Just amazing. And it's a full-time job. I mean, he is literally full-time on the phone. In fact, Howard, I just want you to know that he is looking at me with daggers because he needs the phone. He needs the phone back.
Oh, no.
But he can't have it.
No,
he has his cell phone. He's fine.
Now I feel like the pressure is on because I have to justify this call in cost benefit terms that Essie can't save somebody's life in the next 10 minutes.
Well, we have once a month a seminar at the Cleveland Clinic Wellness Institute where patients come from all across the country,
the world.
We've had people from Israel and Australia and London. I mean, who've just come, but they come for 5 hours just once a week, month, and it's amazing session, and
it's and a five hour prescription. It isn't,
but you know, the thing, Howard, and I know you know this. This whole idea is so simple. It's so easy. I mean, it's as easy as if you just said to someone, "Don't eat any meat, dairy, or oil," and then. I mean, if you're smart, you can just go out and do that. I mean, you don't need hours and hours of training or lessons and lessons and lessons.
And cookbooks and cookbooks and cookbooks.
You could just do it if you don't mind having some meals you don't love sometimes.
Well, I think, you know, you guys in the early 80s pioneered it, and I'm sure you had some meals that you wish you hadn't made. But I think, for a certain percentage of the population, they can go and figure it out. But for everybody else, I think examples like yours, where you're just saying, look, here's another model. Like, everybody in America who has the resources somehow manages to feed themselves and their family every day. Regardless of what it is, we're managing to pick up forks, stick food on them, stick them in our mouths, and get sufficient, calories and nutrients to get up and do our day. It's not a hard thing to do, and with the guidance that you folks are providing around, here are some models. I think what I really appreciate about your cookbooks is that they are so accessible. They're probably the most accessible cookbooks and guides that I've seen anywhere.
Well, we added a few odd things, like Jane said, well, we have to have buffalo. What do they call, Jane? Buffalo wings. But they're with cauliflower. I've never even eaten buffalo wings, but we do have some odd things.
That's another great photo. I think that's the best photo in the book, actually.
Isn't that fun? I know, my mom's like, what is this nonsense? I'm like, believe me, they're trending. They're big deal, football, culture. People will like them. But that's nice of you to say, Howard, because it's true. This our publicist friend had a firefighter contact her. He said, I was getting ready to go to the store to buy things to make some burgers for my firefighter friends. And I looked at the list, and I realized I had everything in my pantry. And I mean, how cool is that for someone who's making, a plant-based burger to not have to go outside, and go to the store or two different stores to get, this is and that's and beet greens and this greens and lemongrass or whatever, because you just don't use that stuff.
Right. And there's people who love doing that. And on occasion, once every 2 or 3 weeks, I'll want to go and try something new or find a recipe that I've never had before and just be amazing. But day in, day out, it's the tried and true. With the less I have to think, the more likely the dish is to get made.
Well, two things. When we started this, Essie and I had been in Puerto Rico, and it had beans and rice with green onions on top. And we loved it. So that actually has evolved into our favorite recipe, our most commonly used recipe, our party recipe, our Christmas Eve recipe, which is just black beans and rice, and then we pile on chopped tomatoes, frozen corn thawed, red peppers chopped, water chestnuts. I mean, you can go on, and great salsas. I mean, if you're having some virgin vegans over, people who think they've never had a vegan meal, but they probably have, they just fall in love with it. And then you can have guacamole as too. I mean, it's just a great, great, fun, colorful dish. All piled on your plate so high that you think, how can anybody possibly eat all that?
And then Anne puts you to shame because her plate's twice as big as yours.
Yeah. So I have one more question about the, you know, the study patients, the people who came to you, you know, more or less at death's door.
And came to my dad, yeah.
Yeah, came to, you know, to learn how to eat. And here's my question, that for me, reading about the studies, reading about nutrition, reading, you know, even Essie's book, even the China study, it made total sense to me, but I hadn't experienced it personally. And like the real light bulb went off for me when I started getting better myself. But even so, like, it really took helping another person. I have a neighbor who was, you know, 280 pounds, diabetic, and I coached him to eat whole food plant-based, and he's now under 200 and off his diabetes meds. And like that, even I had finished working on whole and at that point. So, you know, like, there's no one who should know this stuff really, you know, more confidently than I do, but it really took seeing another person following my advice and getting well to really make me a believer. And I'm wondering what it was like for you to see people who are supposedly at death's door eat their way out of heart disease with your help.
Oh, it's, I mean, I think it's just the most satisfying, amazing, amazing thing to do. We today had an incredible email. I'm just going to see if I can find it to read to you. It's such good work, Howard. I mean, it's such good work. If she's looking for that, like, I know whenever I go away for a week and I'm leaving my husband and kids alone, like, I feel like, yes, I'm going to make a little bit of money doing this, but not, you know, nothing hand over fist. I mean, you know, what do you make from the books? You just keep going. But the work you're doing in the world, it's just good work. It just falls in the category of, you know, this is inspirational, good work of helping people. And, you know, as they say, giving is so much better than receiving, and it's true.
Here's just a little something that just, I mean, literally, I just read it 2 seconds before we talked to you. This is someone who's only been following the diet for 9 months. My husband must have talked to him on the phone. We've never met him, but my husband had asked him to give him a follow-up of how he was doing, and so he sent his amazing labs, and he said, this lifestyle has improved my quality of life. I am physically more fit. I am growing hair on my head. My athletic recovery is the same as it was when I was a kid. Everything is just incredible. I wish they would have taught us about nutrition in medical school and emphasized it as much as they did pharmacology. Through nutrition, real preventive medicine really takes place. So, I mean, that's just a typical comment from people we know, we've never met. You know, it's crazy how miraculous it is.
Yeah,
it's truly a miracle. What happens when people?
How much money you'd have to get paid to compensate for that feeling?
And all these phone calls all day long he does are free.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel like, you know, we're the most selfish people in the world.
Yeah.
You know, like, who has a better job? Who gets more satisfaction out of helping people?
Yeah, wow.
So final question. I'm curious what you guys are, what's next? What you're working on? Any big plans, or just continuing?
Well, my mom and I are still doing a couple things with our cookbook. You know, we have been as, you know, events here and there. So we have a couple more events going on with our book, but there's just endless. My God, my parents this month have been to Lithuania, Texarkana, San Francisco, San Diego, Italy, and they're about to go to Kerpalu and the Dominican Republic. This is all in 4-week period of time, and they're 79 and 80, and they're dealing with all that jet lag and travel and whatnot. So they got a lot going on every day. I've got 3 kids, my small sex ed teaching career, and I'm working on another book project with my brother.
Ooh, can you spill any beans about that, or is it all hush-hush?
Not quite yet because the ink isn't dry, but I think another project will be coming soon from the Engine 2 branch of the family tree, if you will.
That's great.
Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to add that I didn't ask about?
No, you've been great, Howard, and I'm so glad you made the chickpea omelets this morning.
Well, Howard, you really have adapted this, and all your family who we met last summer. That's just amazing. And then, of course, with your work with Colin, just crazy how excellent
it is.
And you came from not. When did you start doing all this change?
Well, I'm a bit of an embarrassment. I started in 1990 and then stopped. You know, I had the golden ring and I dropped it a few times. So.
Yeah, but isn't that cool? It makes you understand it's a process. That's fine. I mean, look where you are now. You had the information and you came back.
It's a paradox because, you know, the best thing you can do is feed your kids this way from day one. And if you're 80 and you start eating this way, you'll make amazing progress.
Yeah.
This really is the most powerful tool I've ever seen. So one of the reasons I keep doing these interviews is so I don't forget again.
Research is me-search. That's good. Yeah.
I like that. All right. Jane Esselstyn and Ann Kreil Esselstyn, authors of the Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease Cookbook and so much more. Thank you guys so much for spending time with me on the Plant Yourself podcast today.
Thank you,
Howard.
Wonderful.
Okay. Talk
to you soon.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hey, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Ann and Jane. And if you're thinking that cooking is kind of a pain and it takes a lot of time and it's a lot of effort, so remember, there's always drugs. You don't need to do lifestyle treatments. You can always take drugs. For example, I was visiting my mom and she was watching a TV show called The Doctors, which I had never seen before. And of course, all the ads are for various prescription medications. And there was one for hot flashes. And so I was listening to all the wonderful ways in which this drug can make women's lives better as they go through menopause. And then, of course, they had to run through quickly the list of side effects. And so they said, Brizdel is not for everyone. You should let your doctor know if you have any of the following symptoms: thoughts of suicide, acting aggressive or violent, new or worse depression, new or worse anxiety or panic attacks, feeling agitated, restless, angry, irritable, trouble sleeping. Wow. Oh, also nervousness, hallucinations, coma, coordination problems or small movements of the muscles so you can't control, racing heartbeat, high or low blood pressure, sweating or fever, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, muscle rigidity, dizziness, flushing, tremors, and seizures. Yeah, so definitely drugs are an option. The side effects for eating a whole food plant-based diet basically include end of brain fog, more energy, less pain, better sleeping, better sex. The list goes on and on. So everything has side effects. The choice is yours, my friends. Talk to you next time. Be well. Let's take this home with some gratitude. First of all, thanks to Mama Earth. You have been so very, very good to me. Second, Will Ridenour donated the use of his beautiful song Sabali Dawn as the theme music for this show. You can find out more about Will's music at willridenour.com. Third, thanks to all the patrons of the Plant Yourself podcast for your financial support. You can read the names of all the patrons at any show notes at plantyourself.com. If you would like to become a patron to show your gratitude for the work I'm doing and help support it, you can do so at plantyourself.com/gift. That's G-I-F-T, all lowercase. And finally, I want to thank you, the listener, for making all of this possible, for giving me a reason to reach out to people, to have conversations, to edit, produce, publicize all the stuff that I do is for you, so that we can continue to have conversations and continue to ripple out healing and transformation into the world.